So we are in part 6 of the Song of Songs, but tonight's going to be a little broader than some of the past nights. We're going to be looking kind of at an overview of the whole book again, and looking at what I think is one of the most important themes or lessons from the Song of Songs, and that is how to love God in every season of our life. Because the journey of Song of Songs takes place over a whole lot of very different seasons in the life of the bride, where she's going through seasons of refreshing and seasons of testing, where she's going through the good, the bad, and the ugly, and it's all from the Lord, and it's all used by Him to produce wholehearted love in her. And as we walk through life, we're going to face all sorts of different seasons, and while we often think it's easiest to love the Lord during those seasons of refreshing and blessing, the call on us is to love Him in every season. And there is a purpose and a reason for every season that God allows to come to our life. And they all have unique things that they bring to our walk with the Lord. And as we start to see those and recognize them, it both lets us go through those seasons without being stressed out by them, and it also lets us partner with what God's doing in those seasons. That what He's wanting to work in us in that season, we could see it, and we could partner with it rather than being frustrated by that season of our life, or ultimately ending up stuck there longer than we have to be because we're not learning the lesson that He's trying to teach. One of the lessons that we learn is that God uses every season to produce wholehearted love in us. He tells us in Romans 8 that the Lord works together all things for good for those who love God. That God can take every season, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent, and He can use it for His purpose, which is to produce wholehearted love in us. He can use it for His purpose, which is to conform us to His image and to cause us to love Him more. Whether they're of His creation or not, sometimes they're of His creation, sometimes they're our own creation. We bring ourselves into a season of testing because we missed where God actually wanted us to go. And sometimes they're His making. There are seasons in the Song of Songs where she's in a season of testing and of separation from her beloved, not because she chose to, but because He chose to. Because He chose to leave, because there was something He wanted to work in her heart. And so as we start understanding how God uses the seasons of our life to work love in us, it teaches us how we're to respond in each of those seasons. How are we to live and how are we to posture our heart in the different seasons of life? And I've been looking at this one rather a lot from just the broader spectrum of the seasons of life. The Lord says in Acts 17 that He arranges the boundaries of nations, and He determines the appointed times and seasons so that men will seek Him. That God put us here in the nation of America in this generation for a reason, so that we could, in this time and in this season, walk with Him and love Him. And it's kind of an unusual season, and I think it's going to get more and more unusual as we go. But rather than looking at the season in which we live and asking the Lord, why didn't You put me somewhere else where it would be easier to love You, or put me somewhere else where there's not as much darkness around me, or where I'm not going to face the things that I may face in the next coming years and decades, we need to ask the Lord, why did You put me here, and what are You wanting to work in me through the times and the seasons that I'm going to be facing? What do You want to do through the particular trials that are in my life, through the particular blessings that are in my life? What are You working in me, and how do I partner with it? One of the things I've discovered about the Song of Songs is that every time I read it, there's a different part of it that just catches me, and I get stuck there. And that's no accident. The reason why there's a part of it that always catches us is because we find that season that we're in. We find that season that we're walking through right now, and that's going to be the part of the story that speaks to us the loudest, is this is where I am right now. This is where the Lord is with me. So I want to give you permission that as you find that season, as we get to it, to just stay there. When that season that speaks to you, this is where I am with the Lord, just stay in it for a while and just talk to the Lord and ignore me, tune me out. But I'm going to hit them all because I imagine none of us are in the same place. So we're just going to kind of do a broad overview of all these seasons. And you can see very clearly in the story not only what the season looks like, but on how we're supposed to respond to it and what happens when it's done the work that it's supposed to do, so that we can see where this season is supposed to take us. Why is it that the bride is going through these seasons? And so in the Song of Songs, we see seasons of refreshing, of just the blessing of the Lord and just sitting at his feet and receiving his love. We see seasons of separation where her beloved goes off on her own and the bride finds herself by herself and searching for him. We see seasons of stretching where he calls her up higher into a higher walk, into a different place, where he says, come with me, we're going somewhere else now. We see seasons of testing where he allows her to experience suffering and pain because of what it produces in her. We see seasons of labor where he calls her to come and work with him, and we see that at the very end, the wilderness season, where the bride comes up out of the wilderness leaning upon her beloved. So we're going to look at all of those in detail. I broke down there kind of the sections of the Song of Songs that are kind of reflecting of that season, and some of them overlap a lot. There's seasons of separation and seasons of testing that tend to go hand in hand a lot. There's seasons of stretching and seasons of separation tend to go hand in hand. And all throughout, you see seasons of refreshing. So we're going to look at those first. It's actually where the story begins, and it's also the most common theme throughout the story. And I've titled the section on seasons of refreshing, I am my beloved's and he is mine. That what the seasons of refreshing work in her heart, the end result of these seasons of refreshing and receiving her love, is that statement, I am my beloved's and he is mine. It's that identity getting written on her heart that who she is loved of God and a lover of God. The seasons of refreshing are those seasons where God is wooing us, where God is pursuing us and winning us in his love. And it's no accident that those are the majority of the story. And most of the time, it's God pouring out his love on us because that's what we need the most. And most of the time, we think we're really good at seasons of refreshing, but we're not as good at them as we think we are. If we were as good at loving God in the seasons of refreshing as we thought we were, we wouldn't struggle so much with loving him in the other seasons. Because one of the major purposes of the seasons of refreshing is to prepare us for the seasons of testing, and to prepare us for the seasons of stretching. It's to work something in us that then stays in the DNA of who we are, so that when we face those times of testing and struggle, we face them with an identity and a reality written on our hearts of God's love for us. But the way we recognize the seasons of refreshing is that there's those times of his nearness where God's love is very near and very obvious and very real to us, where we're just experiencing the joys of loving God, and we just feel him encountering us and just meeting us in his love every day, where we're just getting the blessing from the Lord of just him speaking his love over us. And she sees this all throughout the beginning of the story in the first and second chapters. She says in chapter 2, verse 6, his left hand is under my head and his right hand embraces me. It's that nearness, that he is actually there. His presence is there and we're receiving his love. It's that season of refreshing. It's a season of just resting in his presence and receiving his love. She talks about how she rests under the shade of his tree, that she just, as she says, in his shade I delighted and I sat down, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. He brought me to his banqueting house, and his banner over me is love. It's that season where God just invites us into the goodness of his heart, and we're just rejoicing in the blessing of who he is, in enjoying the wonders of his love and just receiving it. And those seasons that we tend to almost belittle them below seasons of testing or of labor. We exalt the seasons of ministry or the seasons of being tested. The seasons of refreshing are critical to forming who we are in God. Jesus says in Luke 10, talking about Mary and Martha, Martha was worried about many things in serving the Lord, but Mary sat at his feet and heard his word. And Jesus says in verse 41 to Martha, Martha, you are worried and you are troubled about many things, but one thing is needed, and Mary has chosen that good part which will not be taken away from her. Learning to rest in God and to receive seasons of refreshing and to sit at his feet and to receive all that we can from those times when he's pouring out on us is one of the most important things that we can learn in God. how to sit at his feet and how to stay in a season of refreshing. One of the things about seasons of refreshing is that they come to an end, but when they end, we want it to be of him and not of us. That he got up and said, we're moving over here, not we got impatient and started going over there. We need to learn to sit for as long as he will allow, because he knows how much refreshing we need. As long as he is allowing us to sit in his presence and just enjoy his love, and he's not making us uncomfortable there, stay there. He's not calling us to go anywhere else yet. We need to receive the refreshing that he wants to give. But the reason for the season of refreshing is that the Lord wants to grow in us a firm identity of who we are as a lover of God and as the beloved of God. He uses those seasons to give birth in our hearts to those words we find her speaking in chapter 1 of, the king has brought me into his chambers, and dark am I yet lovely. It's his season to teach us of who we are and to teach us of how he feels towards us, to birth in us that foundation and that identity of love. It's where we get that Ephesians 3 reality of being rooted and grounded in God's love. We want to take seasons of refreshing and let them build in us an identity. Because that reality that she carries on her heart of, dark am I yet lovely, and the king has brought me into his chambers, that he desires me and he sees beauty in me, is what enables her to respond rightly in every other season. It's the fact that she received this season of refreshing that enables her to respond to the rest of the seasons. When he gets up and leaves and there's a season of separation, if we don't carry in our hearts that reality that the king has brought me into his chamber and he desires me, we won't get up and follow. We'll stay where we are, assuming that he left because he doesn't want to be with us anymore. We get this idea in our heart that God is angry with us or disappointed with us, and he left because he doesn't want to be found. And unless we receive the message that God wants to write on our heart in the seasons of refreshing, we'll never be prepared for the other seasons. In the season of refreshing, the best thing for us to be doing with our time is to feed on the revelation of God's love, to feed on all that God has done for us in his love and all that he has prepared for us in his love. I've decided, in order to hit my target, that I'm not going to be able to spend an entire night talking about God who makes the first move, God who pursues us in his love before we've ever pursued him. But the heart of that reality is really here in these three verses. The first thing she discovers about his love, she realizes, the king has brought me into his chambers. It's that invitation that he gives at the very beginning of the story of inviting her into his presence. In his presence, and there's plenty more that run along this lines in the end of chapter 1 and the beginning of chapter 2. But she says, the beams of our house are cedars and our rafters are firs. Now this is in the very beginning of their relationship. And what she's discovering is that while he has just invited her into his love, he has already prepared for her a house. And I have no idea what this means in the story, but it's really cool in the allegory. It's that awakening of the believer's heart to realize that God, before eternity passed, prepared a place for us in heaven in his presence. He prepared for us in eternity past a place for us and him to dwell together. And his desire has always been that we would dwell together. She's crying out in the beginning of chapter 1. She says, let me follow you, draw me away with you, and let us go. And then she discovers that he's already got this place prepared, and that he has destined in advance that we would dwell with him, and that his house is ready and he's prepared a place for us. And Jesus says the same thing in the New Testament, that I go to prepare a place for you, that the Lord has prepared for us a place in his presence. He has prepared from before the beginning of us ever acknowledging him that we would dwell in his presence. At the end of chapter 3, she gets another one of those revelations of how he has first loved her. She sees the king coming on his wedding day, and the whole end of it, verses 6 through 11, is this picture of him coming on his wedding day. But at the end of it, she says, come out, you daughters of Zion, and look upon the king wearing the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day of the gladness of his heart. And so she's looking forward and seeing the day of their coming wedding. She's seeing the day of fullness, the day that all things are coming to. And so we have, In seasons of refreshing, we have the ability and really the need to feed on the love of God, not just in the present, in the now, but in the past and in the future, to get that perspective of God's eternal love for us. Because if we sit just in the, we're receiving his love now, and so I'm convinced that he loves me now, then in the moment that season of refreshing breaks off, we forget whether he still loves us or not. It's in receiving the reality of God, of his love for us from eternity past to eternity present, which he wants to speak, and he will in those seasons, is what plants our heart in the reality that I am my beloved's and he is mine. And then we come out of a season of refreshing and into a season of separation, and we're not shaken in the least in the reality of who we are before God. Colossians 3 tells us to set our minds on those things that are above, for we are seated with Christ in heavenly places. We are hidden with Christ in God. Because we are taken into his chambers, we are to set our mind on that place and to continuously remind ourselves that that is the place where God has taken us, that he has brought us into his presence. He has brought us into the presence of God and to the right hand of God. Hebrews 11 really parallels with the whole idea of him preparing a house for us. It says that Abraham, by faith, set out from a land not knowing where he was going, because he was looking to a city whose builder and maker is God. He was looking to that place that he knew that the Lord had prepared for him in advance. He was looking for that heavenly Jerusalem that he knew that the Lord had prepared. And it says in verse 16 that God is not ashamed to be called the God of them, because he has prepared a city for them, because they desire that heavenly country. One of the things we feed ourselves on in seasons of refreshing is the reality of heaven, the reality of that place prepared for us in God's presence, the reality of eternity, that we will be with him for eternity, as one of these strongest revelations to feed ourselves on, so that we're prepared when a season of testing comes. So when the season of testing comes, it is just a momentary and light affliction in the face of an eternal weight of glory that's yet to come, if we're feeding on the reality of loving God for all of eternity. And in Matthew 25, Jesus, in the parable of the 10 virgins, says, "A cry was heard, behold, the bridegroom is coming, go out to meet him." We have to feed ourselves on the revelation of our bridegroom who is coming, that we have a bridegroom who is coming for us one day, that God has prepared in advance a wedding day, the day of the gladness of his heart, and that there is a day of fullness coming when God will come and receive us to himself, and we will live in love with him forever. In the seasons of God pouring out his love on us, we get to grow in this reality of God as our bridegroom, and the end result of that is that God as our bridegroom will come for us, and we will live with him forever. That there is an end to the story, and the end to the story lasts forever, and it's in season of refreshing. It's probably the best news that we have in terms of loving God, is that loving God is a journey that carries us through all these different seasons, but the end of it is one long, eternally long season of refreshing. We are forever going to live in his presence and just drink of his love. And feeding ourselves on those realities of the eternal, everlasting love of God is what builds in us a foundation that lets us stand in the times of trial. And then we feed on the revelation of who we are in God's eyes because of his love, of who he says that we are. And we looked at this more in depth last week, but the reality that God says that he desires us and he sees us as beautiful. Psalm 45, it says, "Listen, O daughter, and consider and give ear. Forget your people and your father's house. The king is enthralled by your beauty. Honor him, for he is your Lord." The reality that God is enthralled with our beauty and that he desires what is in our heart is what empowers us to forget the things around us, to forget our people, our father's house, to forget what we're losing, to forget what we're giving up, and to realize what we're gaining. And as we do this, we cultivate that identity as those who belong to God. I am my beloved's and he is mine. That we exist to love him and to be loved by him. And so then our heart is not easily distracted from receiving his love in a season of refreshing. And when the seasons of separation and testing come, we're not shaken in who we are. There's nothing lost because we lose that feeling of his love, because we have written in us the reality of his love. 1 Peter 2 and in Romans 1, it says the same thing, that you are those who belong to Jesus Christ. You are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. One of the more frequently used titles for believers in the New Testament is those belonging to Jesus Christ, that we are his possession. And it's that reality written on us that enables us to live through all these other seasons, to live through seasons of testing and trial. When Jesus takes Peter and reinstates him from the position of having fallen and fallen away during a time of relatively light trials, when he was asked, are you a disciple, a follower of this man? What Jesus does with him that builds into him the strength that he then stands in the face of persecution for the rest of his days and eventually dies a martyr for Christ is he asks him, do you love me? Three times. And he says, because you love me, feed my sheep. He says, your identity is that you love me. And as long as you can say yes to that, you're okay. That's your identity. That's your foundation. You belong to me. Now go. And that strength that is built in us with that identity is what lets us stand in the other seasons of life. The seasons of separation. I titled this one, I Will Seek the One I Love. That when God leaves, the response of our heart when we're not feeling his presence is to seek him, to search him out, to hunger for him and to thirst for him and to cry out for his presence. Seasons of refreshing, unfortunately, are not the exclusive content of our life. We wish they were, but they're not. They will inevitably give way either to seasons of separation or seasons of seeking. That sometimes it's because we miss an invitation, and sometimes it's because God just knows that seeking is good for us. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. That there is something that is worked in our hearts when we're hungering for God's presence and not receiving it so easily that can't be worked in us in those seasons of refreshing. There's something that's worked in us in the days where God is distant that can't be worked in us in the days where he is near. I think of it as what she says at the beginning of the song. She says, your love is better than wine. Which is really easy to say when you're in the banqueting house and you're enjoying the wine right alongside his love. Enjoying his love with the wine is so much better than just the wine. But what actually makes us realize that his love is better than wine is when we don't have his love anymore and all we're stuck with is the wine. It's that requirement, that question that gets asked that wasn't asked before, that now we have to choose between desiring God who we don't have or accepting what we do have and living in the world. There's something that's worked in our heart in separation that's not worked in nearness. And there's really two seasons of separation in the Song of Songs, and they happen for totally different reasons. And the first one is because she told him to leave. She says in chapter 2, verse 17, until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, turn, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of separation. He comes to her, he calls to her to go leaping on the mountains with him, to go run with him, to follow him where he's going, and she says, no, you go, I'll stay. And so she finds herself in a season of separation of her own making, that she did not respond to his invitation. And she says, by night on my bed I sought the one I love, and I sought him but did not find him. She comes to the realization that because she told him to leave, he actually left. Because she did not get up and follow, he actually went on his way. But the second season of separation happens when she does nothing wrong. It says, I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but I could not find him. I called him, but he gave no answer. And the longer story of that in chapter 5 is he comes, he knocks on her door while she's asleep. She gets up out of her bed, goes to the door, and by the time she gets there, he's left. It says she calls out the door, and he does not answer. Now, he may be fast, but he probably hasn't actually moved far enough that he's out of range of her voice. He's chosen not to respond, and he's chosen to knock and then leave. It's God's choice to lead us into seasons of separation sometimes, because there's something he wants to work in our heart. There are times when he will not be as near to us as he had been in times past, not because we did anything wrong whatsoever, but because God knows that there's something he needs to work in our heart. And that something is hunger and longing. God wants to produce in us a hunger and a longing that will make the next season of refreshing all that much more enjoyable, and that will produce in us that clinginess to God, where we cling to his presence and we don't want to let go, where we know what it's like to be outside of his presence and so we don't take it lightly to be in his presence. In chapter 3, after she gets up out of her bed, having realized that he's left, and she goes and seeks him out in the city, she says, "When I found the one my soul loves, I held on to him and I would not let him go." That season of separation where she experienced his absence, where she experienced that separation from the nearness of God, built something in her to where when she found him, now she's holding on more tightly. Now she's clinging to that presence of God, because the hunger and the longing of that season of not being with him awakens something in her heart to take more valuably the times where she is with him and to cling more to his presence. It also awakens in her something to where you never again hear her say, "Go on your way to the mountains of separation." Never again does she say, "You go, I'll stay." She follows him for the rest of the story, because something was awakened in her heart during that season of being separate from his presence. In chapter 5, after the story there, after he leaves her intentionally, she's wandering the city and she stumbles upon the daughters of Jerusalem, and she says, I charge you, daughters of Jerusalem, if you see my beloved, what will you tell him? Tell him I am lovesick. She actually comes to a realization about her own love because she had to get up and seek. As she's searching through the cities in the middle of the night, she's confronted with the watchman who beat her and bruised her. And she's still out searching when the morning comes and she meets the daughters of Jerusalem, and she comes to a realization about her own heart that she loves him, that she is truly lovesick. When God is absent and still we're loving him and pining for him and hungering him, it gives us a revelation about our own hearts that we are truly and deeply in love with God. Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount, "Blessed are you who hunger now, for you shall be filled. Blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh." The more our heart gets to experience what it means to be separated from God, the more we will love it when we're brought into his presence forever. It's works something in us that for all of eternity is going to make us joyous in his presence. That we have had the experience of being separated from God. It's one of those things that I meditate on every now and then, as just what it will be like when we are before the throne of God and it says we are to the praise of his glory. That there is something that human beings can give God in terms of praise that none of the angelic beings can do. And one of them is this reality that we know what it means to be separated from his presence. The angelic beings have never once been separated from the presence of God. They don't know what it means to hunger for God or to long for God. They don't know what it means to seek him out or to search for him. There is no such reality in the eyes of the living creatures. They have been in his presence for all of eternity. But we get to carry with us a heart that knows what it's like to be separate from God and then stand in his presence for the rest of eternity and enjoy it, because we know what it's like to be in the other place. We know what it's like to be in that place where God is not near and we're not experiencing his presence. And Psalm 63, I think, is one of the greatest examples of this kind of season, and it happens in David's life and what it works in him. David says in Psalm 63, "God, you are my God, I shall seek you earnestly. My soul thirsts for you, my flesh yearns for you, in a dry and a weary land where there is no water." And so he's in a season of his life where he's separated from God and he's hungering and thirsting for the Lord's presence. But then it's immediately contrasted by verse 5 in the psalm. He says, "My soul is satisfied as with marrow and fatness, and my mouth will offer praises with joyful lips." It says, "When I remember you on my bed, I meditate on you in the night watches, for you have been my hope, and in the shadow of your wings I sing for joy. My soul clings to you, and your right hand upholds me." David experiences a season of hungering and thirsting for God, and the reality of that coming out of it on the other side is he is satisfied as with marrow and fatness, and praises come off joyful lips, and his soul clings to the Lord, because your right hand has upheld me in the season of testing. It's that contrast between thirsting and hungering and then being satisfied for God that enables our hearts to enjoy him so much. And it's that season of being thirsting and hungering for God and separate from his presence that causes our soul to cling to him. That when we're in his presence, we do not let go. And the response of our heart in those seasons of seeking has to be to seasons of separation has to be to rise up and seek, to hunger for his presence. Chapter 3, she's just said, I searched for him on my bed, but I did not find him. He was not there with me. So I will rise now, and I will go about the city in the streets and in the squares, and I will seek the one my soul loves. The response of a heart in love when God is separate is we seek for him, not because we can find him, but because we want to find him, because we need to find him. Not because the strength of our seeking will draw us closer to him if he's chosen to hide himself, but because the testimony of our heart when we're in love is that we seek for him, and when he sees it, he chooses to be found by us. David says in Psalm 27, God, Lord, when you said, seek my face, my heart said to you, your face, Lord, I will seek. When God says, seek me, which is what he says every time he hides, he says, seek me. When God chooses to separate himself from us, what's always on his heart is seek me, come and find me. And David says, my heart responds and says, your face, Lord, I will seek. What empowers us in those seasons of separation is the revelation that he loves us. That revelation from the seasons of refreshing and from the testimony of his words over us and from the testimony of his deeds towards us, that he has loved us with an everlasting love. Because we know he loves us, we know that he's not hiding from us because he's disappointed or angry. He's hiding because he wants to be sought out. He's hiding because he wants us to seek him, and when we seek him, we will find him. In chapter 3, the encounter there, it's really interesting that this in this case, he's actually been gone for, we don't know how long, but a long time. He came sometime in the morning, and he called to her and said, arise and go with me. And she said, no, go your own way. And it wasn't until she laid down at night, that night or maybe some nights later, that she realized that she misses his presence, and she decided to get up and seek. And yet it says, as soon as she gets up, she encounters the watchman of the city. She says, have you seen him? They say no. And she goes right past them, and there he is, which I think is fascinating. And there's a whole theory behind that, but I might skip it. But the watchmen don't see him. They have no idea he's there. And yet as soon as she goes past him, there he is. It's him choosing to be found, even though he should by now be miles away from her. And there's this thing in God's heart that loves to be found. He says, I love those who love me, and those who seek me diligently will find me. Proverbs 25 says that it's the glory of God to hide a matter, but it's the glory of a king to search it out. God loves to hide because he loves to be sought out. He loves to be sought after. He loves that testimony of our heart that we're hungering and we're thirsting and we're seeking after him and that we actually miss his presence. He loves that verse 1 reality of, I was in my bed and I sought him in my bed and he was not there. That I was looking for the Lord's presence and it wasn't there. The seasons of stretching. Oh, these are so much fun. God in his love will meet us where we're at. He will meet us in our immaturity, in our total lack of love, in our totally unprepared, unwilling heart, and he will love us in the midst of it. It's where we find the beloved in the beginning of the story. She says in verse 6 that my heart, well, she doesn't say my heart. She says my vineyard, but her vineyard is symbolic of the heart. She says, my own vineyard I have neglected. Her heart has been neglected. It's unprepared. She's totally unready to love him. And yet he meets her there and invites her into his presence. God calls us beautiful just where we are. That he says to her in chapter 4, and we looked at this one last week, that you are altogether beautiful and there is no flaw in you. Long before her love has come anywhere near to maturity. Long before her love for him has come anywhere close to maturity. And while there's still a whole bunch of things that he's going to ask her to grow in, and he's going to stretch her in, and he's going to ask her to follow him in. But he meets us where we are, and then he calls us to rise up and to follow, to let him work something still more beautiful in us, to let him continue the work that he's doing in our hearts. And we see this in chapter 2, where he comes to her, leaping on the mountains and skipping on the hills, and he says, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away with me. O my dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the secret places of the cliff, let me see your face and let me hear your voice. For your voice is sweet and your face is lovely. Catch for us the foxes, the little foxes that ruin the vineyards, our vineyards that are in bloom. And so he's calling her to come up out of the place that she's hiding, for one. and to deal with her compromises for two. When he calls her to deal with the foxes that are marring her heart, the foxes that are ruining her vineyards, he's talking about to deal with those things that are ruining your heart, that are spoiling your heart, that are interfering with our love. I want you to deal with those compromises. And sometimes he calls us up to run with him in ministry. Sometimes he calls us to remove those things that are hindering our love. Sometimes he calls us to yield our hearts. In chapter 4, he calls to her, "Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. You are a garden enclosed and a fountain sealed." There's this part of her that is still locked up and at a distance from him. And actually, in the full text of that chapter, he talks about how her love is a stream that flows down from the mountains of Lebanon. In other words, that it gets to him eventually. It's flowing down out of this locked garden up on the top of a mountain, and eventually her love makes it to him. But he calls her to open up her heart and to let him actually come in to the fullness of her heart and to have it all. So sometimes he calls us just to yield more of our heart, something that we've kept locked up from him that he wants to come in and enjoy, that he wants to come in and receive. He looks at her heart as a paradise waiting to be had. He calls it a paradise of pomegranates and precious fruits and all the finest spices. It's his longing to come in and receive the fullness of our heart. But whatever he calls us to, he always calls us to come away with him, not to come away to him. That even in the seasons of stretching, is not that God stretches us by wandering off and then waiting for us to catch up with him. He calls us to come with him and to walk alongside him through that season, through that transition, moving us from one place to the next place that he's called us. And he uses these seasons of stretching as opportunities for us to show our love. It's interesting that when God stretches us, when he comes to her and he calls her to rise up, it's never an order, it's always an invitation. It's always an opportunity for us to voluntarily give him what he's looking for us to voluntarily give God what he desires and to reach into that next stage of our love, to reach to grow our hearts in love for him. He always gives us opportunities for voluntary love because that's what he's looking for. And after our conference back in the middle of the summer on just loving the Lord and on intimacy with God, I just had a lot of time to think about what does wholehearted love really mean. And to me, the very best definition of wholehearted love is declining the option to say no. That we have decided in our heart that there's no longer an option to say no. I don't need that option. He gives us that option, but I don't need that option. I no longer need the option to say no to God. I no longer need the option to turn down his invitations. That whenever he says, "Rise up and follow," I'll go. Whatever he asks me to give, I'll give. Wherever he asks me to change, I'll change. Jesus talks about the first commandment and loving the Lord your God, and he says it's to be done with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And without question, that is a journey. No one gets saved and immediately starts loving the Lord with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our mind, and with all our strength. He asks us slowly and over time to yield one part and then another and then another and then another. And it's these seasons of stretching that let us actually do that, that let us actually reach for wholehearted love. And what enables us to do that again is that security of his love. The whole of chapter 4 is one long description of his love for her until it gets to the very last verse. And after he spent 15 verses telling her how much he loves her just exactly as she is and how much he loves all that's still hidden away in her heart, then she gets a chance to respond. And because of that perfect love, she can respond and say, "Awake, O north wind, and come, O south, blow upon my garden, that its spices may flow out, and let my beloved come into his garden and eat his pleasant fruits." Because of the security of his love, she says, "I'll open my heart wide to the good things and to the bad. I will let the winds blow through so that it will be open for my beloved to come into his garden." I will yield those areas of my heart, those things that I'm trying to guard, those things that I'm trying to hold back and protect because I don't feel secure there. I will yield those things that he can come in and have what is his. The seasons of testing, almost as much fun. The seasons of testing put the title, Tell Him I'm Lovesick, which is what she says in chapter 5, verse 9, in the middle of this long season of testing. And I put part of it there, but the longer story is he comes, he knocks on the door. She responds, she goes to answer him, but when she answers, he's not there. She says in verse 6, I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but I could not find him. I called him, but he gave no answer. So we see a very different picture in this one than in chapter 3. Chapter 3, she gets up, she goes and seeks, and she almost immediately runs into him. And it's the grace of God that he starts us with very small seasons of separation and seasons of trial. That in our first seasons of separation, the moment we get up to seek, we find him. But eventually these longer seasons come where she's searching and she's not finding. And so all night now she's searching, and it says, the watchmen found me as they went about the city. They beat me, they bruised me, they took away my veil, those watchmen of the walls. And what's happening in the context of Israel in 1000 BC is the watchmen are there not only to guard against outside invaders, they're there to guard against immorality. One of their purposes or their assignments while they're wandering the streets in the middle of the night is to look for loose women who are out wandering the streets and engaging in adultery or in prostitution. And so when they come across her and she's searching and wandering about the city in the middle of the night, they think she's a prostitute. And so they beat her and bruise her, and they take away her veil. And so she's in the middle of this season of testing, where not only is he separate from her, not only is he absent, but she's been searching and searching, and she can't find him. And then in the midst of the searching, the watchmen who were there to protect her have accused her of something, have beaten her and bruised her. So she's physically injured, she's reputationally injured, if that works as a word. They've accused her of a crime that she hasn't committed, and she's standing there humiliated and beaten. And God allows these times of testing to produce a testimony of love. He never makes us a promise that our lives will be easy once we're saved, as much as we would like to say to the contrary. There is no such promise anywhere in Scripture. But he does promise that we will find trials and we will find peace in the midst of trials. He says in John 16, these things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation, but be of good cheer, for I have overcome the world. Seasons of testing produce in us a testimony of love, because love is demonstrated through suffering. Love is demonstrated in the laying down of our life and the taking up of our cross. In chapter 4, in part of his description of his own love, he's telling her how beautiful he finds her, and then he says in the middle of it, until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, I will go my way to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of frankincense. He says, in terms of the allegory, this is Jesus speaking. He says, until the day breaks and the shadows flee away, which is a really interesting phrase, because when the day breaks is actually when the shadows show up. But in God's eternity, the day will break that will last forever, and there will be no shadows. And he's speaking in his love of how God, until eternity comes, until the day comes that we are with him and we are one with him, and he is at rest and we are at rest, Jesus has embraced suffering and death, not only at the cross, but from then until eternity comes. And Jesus is still in sorrow and in anguish over the state of the world, and he has embraced that because of the day of eternity that is coming. And the mountain of myrrh speaks of death. Myrrh was an embalming oil. It was used to prepare bodies for the grave. And the hill of frankincense speaks of suffering. That frankincense was an herb that they got the perfume out of it by crushing it. And so those two symbols are used throughout the Bible for death and for suffering. And they're two of the gifts that are given to Jesus when he's born. Gold to say that he's a king, and frankincense to myrrh to say that he's a king who would suffer and who would die for his people. And so suffering and death, laying down our life in seasons of testing, is what produces the testimony of love. There's something that trials give us that easy times don't. It's that the reality that the tough times and trials pull out the deepest things in our heart. And one of the things they pull out of her is a self-revelation that we talked about earlier in verse 9, where she says, what will you tell him? Tell him I am lovesick. Where she discovers for herself the depths of her own love, that in that own trial she realized how much love is in her heart for him. It caused her to have to search and to question the amount of love that's in her own heart, and she found that there was more there than she expected. But it also produces a public testimony. And this is one of my favorite chapters in the Song of Songs, because it's really, in terms of ministry and of who we are in reaching out to the public, it's that really what I aim for and what we're here for, is that in the midst of our seeking for God, we would be a testimony to the eyes of those who are not yet seeking. That our anguish and suffering, if it comes to that, in the midst of our searching for God, would be a testimony to those who are comfortable and not searching. It says, how is your beloved? She gives the charge to the daughters of Jerusalem. If you find him, what will you tell him? Tell him I am lovesick. And they respond and they say, how is your beloved better than others that you would charge us so? And then she launches into this description of the beauty of her beloved that lasts for the rest of that chapter. My beloved is radiant and ruddy. He is chief among 10,000. He is wholly desirable. This is my beloved and this is my friend. And it's the seeking and the testing and the trial that birthed that out of her, that just description of his beauty, that he is worth it. He is altogether beautiful, and he is absolutely worth what I just went through. She's gone through trial, and what comes out of it, because of the love that's being worked in here, rather than offense, is a description of his beauty and an even deeper love for him. But the result of it is, the daughters of Jerusalem see it, and they respond in chapter 6 and say, where has your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Where has he gone that we may seek him with you? It awakens that seeking and searching heart in others because of the testimony that she gave during her season of trial. The lovesick heart in a season of trial and testing refuses to be offended, but instead focuses on the testimony that our trials are producing. The testimony, first of all, before the eyes of God, and then secondly, before the eyes of men. We are giving a testimony for our own love before the eyes of God, that he sees our sacrifice, he sees our suffering, he sees our seeking, he sees our trial, and he receives that as love. And secondly, that those around us are seeing it and is causing them to fall in love with him. And that's where our heart goes when we're lovesick. That's how we position our hearts in a season of testing, is we put our focus on the testimony that we're producing for the one that we love, on the testimony of love that is being created for us in this season of testing. She says, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, what will you tell him? Tell him I am lovesick. And we don't really know what other alternative she was contemplating after she asked that question, but I like to speculate. She says, what will you tell him? By all rights, what they should tell him is, that was a dirty trick. Why did you knock on my door and then go away? Look what happened to me. Now I was stuck in the city and I was out wandering the streets and the watchmen beat me up and they think I'm a prostitute. Could you come back and tell them I'm really not? Could you help me out a little here? But instead of having any of that going through her mind or her heart, the one thing that she wants to say, the one message that's on her lips, is tell my beloved that I am lovesick. She doesn't even talk to the daughters of Jerusalem to try to explain why she's naked and bruised and beaten on the streets in the middle of the night. She doesn't even try to defend herself that she's not a harlot. She doesn't even try to make things right. The only thing that she has that she considers worth saying is, tell my beloved that I am lovesick. If anything comes out of what just happened to me, let him know that I am lovesick. And it's those eyes that are fixed on his eyes and on his opinion and on how he sees the event that is what enables us to go through a time of testing. It's what enables us to go through a season of testing and to carry out of it a testimony rather than a frustrated and a burdened heart. That instead of us feeling offended at God because of what he made us go through, we come out of it more in love with him because of what it looked like to his eyes and because of the way that he received it as love. And her heart is so set in that place that his opinion is the only one that matters, that she's able to give that testimony rather than having an offended heart. The seasons of labors. This is one of the more interesting seasons. God actually calls us to labor, whether it's in the marketplace or in our family or in ministry. He actually has things that he sets before us that he wants us to do. It's part of who we were created to be. We were created to work. God created Adam and set him in the garden to tend the garden. Before the curse, Adam had a job. He had an assignment. He had a labor on the earth. What God desires is that we would learn to labor with him in love. We would learn to take our labors and to use them to love God. The purpose of our labors is to give us a context in which to love God beyond just sitting idly in paradise. There is so much about God that we would never know if we were just sitting in paradise and God was feeding us grapes all day long. Our labors, our life here on the earth, and everything that that means in terms of relationships, in terms of work, in terms of ministry, in terms of people around us who frustrate us and people around us who frustrate us slightly less, is all here as a context in which for us to discover God's heart and for us to love him. We cannot fully love God without that context and that reality. It's why he created the world. God created the earth because we needed some place in which to meet with him and to love him. He could have created us to dwell in heaven like the angels, but then we wouldn't be who we are, and we wouldn't have that testimony and that love and that praise that he wanted to work in us. He created us to work. The danger is that our labors have the potential to distract us from God rather than lead us to God and cause our hearts to be neglected. In chapter 1, this is where we find her. She's been laboring, and it hasn't been a labor of love. She's just been laboring. She says, "My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I have not kept." Because of the assignment that she was working on the earth, because of her labors in the vineyards, she neglected her own heart. She neglected keeping up her own heart in love with God. Work was part of God's good creation. The curse on work was that we would now be working to sustain ourselves rather than working to meet with God. Adam's original assignment was to work and to labor in the garden to prepare a resting place for God. The purpose of his work was so that he could meet God in it, so that God could come and tell him what a good job he was doing in his work, so that God could come and walk alongside him as he was tending in the garden, so that God could bring the animals to him and have him name them, so that God and Adam could labor together in that place, that context that God had created for him. The curse was, God says, "Now, by the sweat of your brow, you will eat of the earth." Adam's food, it says that God planted every tree that was good for food, and he planted them grown, and they're there in the garden, and Adam's just picking fruit off trees and eating them. He was not laboring to feed himself. He was laboring because it was a context for him to meet with God and to labor alongside God. And the curse took that away, and God wants to redeem that. That we would labor not unto ourselves, not as a means of sustaining ourselves, but as a place and a context where we could meet with God, that we would see our work that way. Yes, we're here on this earth and we're working, and yes, it does give us money, but that's not the point. God could give us money in another way if he wanted to. He could give us food in another way if he wanted to. He chose for us to have to work to get the food for our hands because he wants us to meet with him in that context. And our heart, when it positions itself in that place that I'm laboring because it's a place for me to meet with God, we labor differently than when we labor without him. That our labors are now unto God and our labors are now with God. We're not just laboring for him, but we're laboring with him. That God is there alongside us as we work. Chapter 7, she says, "Come, my beloved, and let us go into the fields and lodge in the villages. Let us go out early to the vineyards and see whether the vines have budded, whether the grape blossoms have opened and the pomegranates are in bloom, and there I will give you my love." That "there I will give you my love" is the heart of love and labor. That in this place where I am, where I'm working, that's the place where I'll give you my love. This is where you have me, so that's where I'm going to give you my love. Colossians 3 says, "Whatever you do in word or deed, do it in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him." That whatever we're doing, we can take it as a context in which to love God, as a place in which to love God. Now, if you can imagine this journey that the bride is on, she started working in a vineyard. Working in a vineyard for the sake of her brother, she was slaving, slave labor there, more or less. She was being burned by the sun, and it was destroying her own heart. And now we get towards the end of the story, and her beloved is asking her to go back into the vineyards. You know, you would think that a king, having now set his attention on her, that she would be okay, she could ditch the vineyards and go live in his palace forever and no longer have to work, but he asked her to go back to the vineyards. And God will still ask us to labor. He will still lead us into places of working, but now it's working with him. Now it's her own heart volunteering to go out and to labor with him in the vineyards. There I will give you my love, because she knows that's where his heart is at. She knows that's where he's working and where he wants to meet with her. Now, the last season that Song of Songs gives us a picture of is the wilderness season. Wilderness seasons, I'm finding, are really hard to define. They look like a whole lot of different things. Sometimes they're seasons of testing and separation, but sometimes they're actually seasons of refreshing. But the one thing about a wilderness season that it always has is isolation, weakness, and humility. The wilderness seasons are about taking us and breaking us away from everything else that we lean on other than God. They're about taking us and breaking us away from the opinions of man, taking us and breaking us away from our own strength and our own systems and our own abilities, and making us come up leaning on God. In chapter 8, the very last hurdle that she faces in her love is she's asking herself, she says, "It's only you were to me like a brother who was nursed at my mother's breast. Then if I found you outside, I would kiss you and no one would despise me." So this last obstacle that she's facing is that her love for him is being scorned. That as she's yielding herself more and more to him in love, the people around her are not reacting very well. They don't appreciate it. They're despising her and scorning her for it. Who is she that she thinks she can love the king? And she has to choose how she's going to respond to that. And she kind of debates over it in the next few verses. And then in verse 5, the daughters of Jerusalem see her, and they see, who is this coming up from the wilderness leaning on her beloved? She's made that choice in the wilderness that she is going to fully lean and depend upon God, and she does not care about others' opinions, and she does not care about her own strength. The wilderness is designed to take out that last stubborn obstacle in our love, our independence and our pride. When it's done what it's supposed to do, we come up leaning, where we're fully dependent upon God and we're totally unashamed at what others may think of that. Psalm 69, really long psalm, but he's talking about, he says, "Your zeal, because zeal for your house has eaten me up, the reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me. I wept and I chastened my soul with fasting, and that became my reproach." David's talking about how his own family has cut him off. He says, "I've become a stranger to my brothers and alien to my mother's children. I've become a song of the drunkards, that everyone sees him and mocks him because his soul is in anguish over the house of the Lord." Because he's in a season of separation and hunger, because his soul is hungering for the presence of God, he's fasting, he's mourning, and he's in this place and no one gets it. No one understands what's going on with David. They think he's lost his mind. David is so hungry for the Lord and so desiring his presence and desiring that his house would come to Jerusalem. David longing for that day where the Lord's presence, where his glory returns again to Jerusalem. Because of that, no one understands him, and he's in a season of isolation and reproach. But he says in verse 13, "But as for me, my prayer is to you, O Lord, in the acceptable time. O God, in the multitude of your mercy, hear me in the truth of your salvation. Hear me, for your loving kindness is good. Turn to me according to the multitude of your mercies, and do not hide your face from your servant, for I am in trouble." David, because of that place, comes up fully dependent upon God. "The people despise me, they reproach me, but my prayer is to you." That you, God's opinion is the only one that matters, and it's the only thing on which we lean. Oddly enough, God uses the times where we're unseen or ignored or cut off from everyone around us to produce in our hearts the ability to minister to those around us. that what God is working in us when all of those around us are cutting us off or not understanding us, or where we think we're being unseen or ignored, or we don't have a platform, or we're hidden, or we're despised, or we're scorned. What God is working in us in those seasons is what He wants to be in us so that He can put us before the eyes of the public. Those times where God is the only thing we have is what teaches us to live before an audience of one, to care only about the opinion of God, only about what God has to say. Paul says in 1 Corinthians, "With me it is a very small thing that I should be judged by you or by a human court. In fact, I don't even judge myself, for I know nothing against myself, but I am not justified by this. He who judges me is the Lord." That man's opinions don't matter, and even my own opinions don't matter. I live for the opinion of one. I live for the judgment of one. What does God say about my heart? And the wilderness season teaches us to live before that audience of one, that God is the only thing we need. He's the only one we want. God allows seasons of testing and separation, of isolation, of persecution to reach our lives because He has a specific work that He wants to work through Him. God is always and ever working to bring us forth in love. He is always laboring to bring forth wholehearted love in us, to mature us, to bring out all that He has put in us. And as we start to understand how God works in our lives through those seasons, it keeps us from being offended. But more than that, it helps us to partner with what God is doing in that season so that we don't have to stay there any longer than we have to. If we can't learn the lessons of the wilderness in a short time in the wilderness, then God ends up throwing us into the wilderness for a long time. If we don't seek God during the times of separation, we may stay separated for a much longer time than He ever intended. It's as we start to see what God is doing in those seasons, we can actually learn the lessons quicker than we would have if He was just having to do it on us by brute force. And we know what God is trying to work in our hearts, and so we partner with Him in that and we love Him for it. It keeps us from being offended because we see that there is purpose in it, that there is value in it, that God's doing it because He loves us and not because He's angry. Learning to be content in every season of life means recognizing the wisdom of God's leadership and the security of His love and the fleeting nature of those trials. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4 that these momentary light afflictions are working in us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. So we do not look at the things which are seen, but the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things which are not seen are eternal. In the light of the long, long, long season of refreshing and blessing that is coming, these momentary light afflictions are indeed very momentary and very light. And God is working in us something that is going to make that season of blessing that lasts for eternity so much greater. The more we get to walk through seasons of separation and testing, even the dark seasons of this life, they work things in our heart that are going to make eternity that much more enjoyable. They're going to make the presence of God that much more of a blessing to our heart. Having experienced the other, having been through the trials and the separations, that our hearts are now hungry and ready to receive that blessing. It's one of the reasons why God makes us pray. It's still just boggles my mind that God makes us pray. I mean, He asks us to ask Him for things that He already knows we want. But the reason He does things like that is because it makes hunger grow in our hearts. And so then when He gives us what He was already planning to give us long before, it's that much more of a blessing to us. God takes the seasons of this life and He works in us things in our heart that are going to make eternity far more of a blessing than it would have been otherwise. If our life on this earth is entirely comfortable and living and enjoying the wine of this world, then we're not going to be anticipating the kingdom of God all that much. If there were no struggles, if there were no trials, our hearts would not grow hungry for the presence of God and for the restoration of all things in the way that they do. And the good news is we're on a pilgrimage that takes us through a lot of seasons, including suffering. But when our heart is set on that pilgrimage, not only can we find springs of life in every season, but we know that the end of the journey is in Zion, in this eternal season of refreshing in the presence of God. David says it in Psalm 84, "Blessed are those whose strength is in you, who have their hearts set on pilgrimage." As they pass through the valley of suffering, they make it a place of springs, and the autumn rains also cover it with pools. They go from strength to strength till each appears before God in Zion. As we set our hearts to loving God in every season of our life, whatever it looks like, we can make each of those seasons a season of springs and of refreshing, where we're benefiting from that season, even when it's not a season of blessing. And we can set our hearts on that end day when we sit in the presence of God in a day of blessing and refreshing for the rest of eternity that makes these trials look like nothing. God leads us on a journey, and in every season of that journey, He has good in mind for us. And in every season of that journey, we can lock into that good, and we can partner with His work, and we can love Him in it and through it, and come out of it on the other side with a heart that burns more for God, with a heart that's more prepared for dwelling in His presence for eternity. Amen. Father, we thank You for Your perfect leadership. God, for the wisdom of Your heart, that You know how to use every season of our life for our good. God, we thank You that You love us through the midst of every season, whether we brought it on or You brought it on, that You take all of it and You work it for our good. God, we thank You for the end of our journey. God, for the glorious assurance we have that for the rest of eternity we will sit in Your presence, and there will be no more tears and no more sorrow and no more pain. God, that our seasons of sorrow and suffering and trial and separation in this life are the last ones we're going to have. God, I ask that You would give our hearts that grace, that revelation that empowers us to walk through those seasons well and to come out on the other side of them, God, with hearts that burn more in love for You, with hearts that are more prepared for eternity with You. God, would You cause our hearts to see and to recognize the work that You're doing in each season, Lord, so that we could receive the fullness of the love that You have for us in that season, so that our hearts can grow in love, that we could receive what You're desiring to give. God, we thank You that You are with us always. God, that You are, even in those seasons of separation, You are with us in spirit, and You are longing for us to be rejoined to You. That You hide Yourself so that You can be found. That You hide Yourself with the intention of being found, because You are always near to us. God, I ask that You would just walk with us through the seasons of our life, God, and empower us to love You in those seasons. God, let us receive the fullness of the work that You're doing in our hearts, that we could stand before You on that day in Zion with a heart that is fully alive, having experienced all that You intended for us, so that our experience in eternity is all that You meant for it to be. God, we thank You for Your wisdom in seeing the eternal picture, that in everything You do, You see eternity. In everything You're doing in our hearts, You're seeing us together with You for eternity. God, would You give us that same perspective, Lord, that we could look past momentary light afflictions and see the testimony that they're working before Your eyes and the things that they're working in our hearts for all of eternity. God, I ask that You would just give us that singleness of vision that could go through every trial with our eyes locked on You and of what You're seeing and of how You're feeling and responding, that we would be searching more than anything else to leave a testimony before You in everything that we do, that we are lovesick. God, that we love You more than anything, and that Your love is truly better than wine, even when the wine is gone, even when the trials come. God, we thank You for loving us through every season. God, give us the grace to love You in return, to see Your work and to partner with it. And we just thank You for Your perfect love and Your perfect leadership. In Jesus' name, amen.